Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Oh my heavens, look at everybody here. You look like John LeSquaw. Did you know that? Do you know who John LeSquaw is? You look like him. That's why I said, oh my gosh. I was at Murder by the Book in Houston at another one of, you know, there are two or three real place bookstores. Tattered Cover is one, and Murder by the Book and Poison Pen in Scottsdale. And Joe Lansdale showed up, and he drove 100 miles to, we go back a long time. And he showed up, and I was so astonished. And he brought his family. I was so astonished that I introduced him as Joe Haldeman. And then quickly caught my mistake. But so I'm thinking, hey, you know, the authors are following me. So I had Joe Lansdale and, by God, John LeSquaw. I mean, what a hell of a deal. Tremendous. Well, okay, I'll tell you a Rambo story. I was in Poland about 10 years ago on a book tour, because one of the things sometimes a foreign publisher will do is bring you over. And my wife is Polish, and so we thought, hey, this would be pretty cool. So we went over, and it very friendly. You know, in the movies, you imagine Poland is, you know, dour and all. But, I mean, it was really a beautiful country. And they welcomed me in ways that were unnatural. I got the presidential suite. True. I mean, the real presidential suite. Former President Clinton came to town when I did, and he didn't get the presidential suite. No, that's what I meant, unnatural. And on the Warsaw paper, I was, this is unbelievable, I was on the top of the fold, and former President Clinton was down here. And the journalists were lined up seriously from 8 in the morning until 8 at night, day after day, for 15-minute interviews. It's exhausting, but hey, if somebody wants to talk to me and print me in the paper. But more than that, it isn't natural, okay? I mean, I'm not Stephen King, right? So what was this about? So on the second day, a young woman of about 30, and her age is important, a journalist, they speak English very well, and she said, well, you look a little puzzled. I said, yes, I can't believe, you know, it's nice to be popular in Poland, but... And she said, well, you know, I guess no one has explained to you the position that Rambo has in Polish culture. And I said, you're absolutely right. I don't know. So this is the story she told me. She said during the Solidarity years, this is the late 80s, early 90s, the Rambo films were not allowed to be shown in Poland. They were illegal. But copies were smuggled in, and the demonstrators, of which she was one, very young firebrand, would watch the Rambo films, dress up like Rambo, particularly with the sweatband, the bandana, and go out and demonstrate against the soldiers. And so she concluded her explanation by saying, and so you see, in a certain way, you can say that Rambo helped bring about the fall of the Soviet Union. Isn't that cool? And I remember when the Berlin Wall came down, evening news, there was Rambo written on the wall. How cool, you know? So it's been a while since I've been in Denver. I was here in 2005 for a book called Creepers. And as publishers, you know the book?
I was there. Yeah.
You were there? Oh, my God. You don't look a day older. It's the publishers send people this way and that way and that way. And I'm with a company called Mulholland Books, which is a division of Little Brown. And they said, hey, would you like to go to Tattered Cover? And I said, hell yeah, I haven't been there in a long time. So I thank you for coming out to welcome me. And I'd like to tell you about an intellectual adventure I had that led to this new book, Murder is a Fine Art, which is, in if you don't know, a Victorian mystery thriller. And I have a doctorate in American literature, and I taught American literature. I was a full professor in American literature at the University of Iowa for many years. And what is this? You know, it's like, it's like coming out of the closet. You know, I was a Victorianist, and I didn't know it. And how on earth did this happen? I was my friend, my author friend Steve Barry. A year ago, I was telling him about Murder is a Fine Art and, you know, what it was about. And we were at dinner, and he put down his knife and his fork, and he's looking at me, and he's leaning forward, and he says, you reinvented yourself yet again. You know, getting into Victorian London, and how did all this happen? Well, in 2009, I was watching a movie called Creation, which is about Charles Darwin's nervous breakdown. Darwin had a favorite daughter who died. She was sickly, but Darwin had recommended a form of treatment that was well known in the Victorian era called hydrotherapy, which basically a lot of baths, cold baths, hot baths, sweat baths, hot towels, and all that, and she died. And Darwin wondered if perhaps in recommending that form of treatment, he had perhaps hastened her death. Meanwhile, in the middle of writing on The Origin of Species, his wife, a devout Christian, had realized the implications of what he was writing. And she felt that On the Origin of Species would endanger Darwin's soul. And as they got to thinking about this, Darwin began to wonder if God had not killed his daughter in order to give him a warning about the seriousness of the book he was writing. Heavy, heavy stuff. And he had a nervous breakdown. He broke out in sweats. He was sick all the time. He couldn't eat. He couldn't sleep. He had rashes. He was a mess. Now, in the movie, which is set in 1855, a character who has no function in the story except as a messenger shows up and says the following thing. Because the whole point is that in medicine in 1855, no one had the understanding of the way the mind works to link his sweats and his sickness and all this stuff with what was going on with his guilt. It's all before Freud. And this character shows up. In now 1855, Freud published in the 1890s. And he says, you know, Charles, people such as De Quincey are saying that we can be controlled by thoughts and emotions that we don't know we have. And having dropped that heavy line, vanishes from the movie. And as far as I was concerned, the movie stopped right there. I'm thinking, that sure sounds like Freud to me. But Freud, as I said, published 40 years later. So who is this De Quincey they're talking about? And I began to think that they were talking about Thomas De Quincey, who is an author I had read in a long ago romantic literature course. He was most well known, in at least in the course, for having been the first person to write about dope addiction, drug addiction, in a then sensational bestseller called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. Now, understand that the concept of addiction did not exist in Victorian culture. The concept, as we understand it, of chemicals which can control our minds and our bodies in such a way that we become dependent upon them was an unknown thought. They thought of drug abuse as being a habit, and what you had to do was be strong and be forthright and be stout and just stop taking the drugs. Well, De Quincey admitted to using the drug a whole lot and blew the lid off of it in a way because how many people know what laudanum is? Oh, boy, it's an educated crowd.
Your book.
Oh, you read the book, so I know. Now you know my punchlines. Often when I'm addressing people about this, you'd be surprised how many people do not know what laudanum was. It's a mixture of, as you know from the book, if you've read it, 90% alcohol, usually brandy, 10% pulverized opium. It was widely available, legally available, cheaply available. You could buy it from the paper boy, the grocer, the butcher, the landlord, the chemist if you wanted to go to the trouble. It had a skull and crossbones on the label, and it said poison. In spite of that, it was as ever-present in a Victorian home in the medicine cabinet as aspirin is for us today. It was used for everything from baby colic to back pain to toothache, menstrual cramps, cancer, anything that could be troubling you, laudanum was the answer because it was a powerful pain reliever and took away the symptoms. I love the idea they were giving it to babies. On the bottle of many of these, it says, you know, dosage under 3 years, 5 drops. 15 years, so many drops. You know, 25 years, so many drops. And the way it was administered is you'd get a glass of water, and it had a stopper, and it had drops. So, ta 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 ta. If you were not used to it, or even perhaps if you were used to it, one tablespoon would probably kill you. It was that powerful. De Quincey, having started as a college student at Oxford with a toothache, used it recreationally for 10 years until Wordsworth's three-year-old daughter, De Quincey was very fond of the girl. She died suddenly, and De Quincey went mad about it. He spent months on her grave, clawing at the dirt. And that event was enough to tip him over into full-fledged addiction as we understand it. So that if one tablespoon would kill you, he was drinking 16 ounces of it a day. When he wasn't eating opium pills out of a snuff box, a friend of his said he ate them the way, at first he thought they were filberts, kind of nut, that's what he, but no, he was eating opium tablets. Well, I'm sort of getting ahead of myself here. Let's go back to that movie, because I was just puzzled intrigued by this theory, this pre-Freudian theory that vastly anticipated Freud, and I wanted to see if it was true. And you know, when you're talking to readers, the most common question every author gets is, "Where do you get your ideas?" And I'm so, maybe it's because of the professor background that I have, I'm very conscious of when some ideas come to me. And this was a powerful urge that I felt. And I still have my textbooks from when I was in college. So I pulled them down and I started reading De Quincey, and I was breathtaken by the quality of his prose and the quality of his insights. And I was just baffled why in literature classes De Quincey is relegated to footnote status. And it's got to be because of the drugs. So I'm learning all this about, you know, because that's the one to go to place first, Confessions of an English Opium Eater. The consequence of, there were several things that happened to him because of the drugs. One was, in that era, there was a debate among physicians as to whether opium was a exciter or a sedative. For De Quincey, it was an exciter, a stimulant. And he suddenly, it sounds like he was smoking dope or maybe taking LSD or something. He described going to concerts and hearing music between the notes, or going to markets on a Saturday night, which is when the poor were paid, and at masses amount of people at open markets. And he claimed that he could distinguish the details of conversations among all these people within 100 feet of him. The other consequence of the opium was that it caused massive dreams in which he felt that he had lived 100 years, in which he felt that the entire pageant of civilization passed before him, Greece, Rome, on and on and on. He woke up so troubled by the dreams he had had that he began constructing theories about them and the relationship of dreams to the dreamer in ways that anticipate Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams. And he theorized that the mind had secret chambers. I love this. Secret chambers in which alien versions of ourselves could live secretly. Schizophrenia. It sounds so much like Freud. And his works were filled. He was an essayist, he was a novelist, he was a short story writer, he was a book reviewer. My favorite comment as a book reviewer, he said to an author, he said, "Sir, I enjoyed your book so much that I almost finished it." A really, really amusing guy. And he also was, in addition to an expert in theories of the subconscious, which, by the way, is a word he invented. No one can show it for sure, but there are many theories that Freud, who knew De Quincey's work, borrowed subconscious, the term, from De Quincey. But perhaps because of these secret chambers and the alien versions of ourselves, De Quincey was also an expert in murder. And he was particularly fascinated. He wrote about many, many murders, but he was particularly fascinated by the Ratcliffe Highway murders of 1811. And some of you have read the book, so I don't want to. It's difficult to work with an audience who's half of which knows this story and half doesn't. So I'll kind of go down the middle on it. In 1811. In the East End of London, which then was the bad part because it was so near the docks, a shopkeeper, his wife, his shop boy, and his three-month-old baby son were all brutally murdered at midnight. He had sent out a shop girl to buy oysters, which sounds, you know, highfalutin, but in fact was a very common food in that period, cheaply available, and it didn't need cooking. So they ate a lot of it. And she was supposed to go out and pay the oyster or buy the oysters for dinner, for supper, and to pay a baker's bill. This happened at midnight, and people are often surprised that shops were open at midnight on a Saturday night. The workday was 6.5, work week was 6.5 days. So the poor didn't get paid until mid-afternoon, and the shops were closed on Sundays for the most part. Some remained open illegally, but basically if you wanted to get your shopping done for the week, you did it that night. So the stores often stayed open till midnight. And this was a linen shop. It sold underwear, it sold shirts, it sold socks. And the girl couldn't find anybody selling oysters, and the baker was closed, so she comes back, can't get the door open. She knocks, nobody answers, then she hears footsteps on the other side, then she hears breathing on the other side, and then she gets freaked out. And a watchman comes along. There were no police in London in 1811. That came later. And the watchman came along, and he was an old guy. They tended to be old, and they carried a lantern, and they called out the hours, which sounds to me like it'd be kind of annoying. And, you know, midnight and all is well, that kind of thing. You know, if they did find trouble, I don't know what they were going to do about it because they had no authority, and they were not all that virile. So anyway, the old guy comes up and says, "What's the matter?" And then a neighbor comes out and says, "Yeah, what's going on? I'm ready to go to bed. What's, you know, stop making all this noise." And so she tells the story. And the neighbor says, "I'll go in through the back of my house. I'll crawl over the wall. I'll come in this time." And he did. The door was open, and he found everybody dead. Their heads had been smashed in with a ship carpenter's mallet, which the killer had left on the scene. And in addition, everybody had had their throats cut, including the three-month-old baby, which is why this got so much attention. The killer had taken the mallet and smashed the wicker carriage and then piled everything up on top of the baby. I mean, this hideous stuff. Now, what's more interesting, in a way, there were probably mass murders in England prior to this. It's just that nobody knew about them. What had made the difference in the last 30 years was an improved road system. And it's kind of cool. It's called a macadamized road. I don't go into detail about it in the book. But basically, a very clever man, an engineer, had roads designed in which there were large chipped rocks layered with smaller chipped rocks, layered with even smaller chipped rocks. And these compacted down, and the road was beveled this way so that drainage went into the ditches. And it vastly improved the ability of people to travel and made possible the English mail coach system, which De Quincey was fascinated about, and it wrote a major essay about it called The English Mail Coach. And basically, they took passengers, four inside and three riding on the top, but more important, they took the mail and London's, count them, 52 newspapers. 52 newspapers. At a reliable 10 miles an hour, how speedy for the time it was, even though we chuckle, 10 miles an hour, so that within 2.5 days, all of the British Isles knew about these murders. And the information caused the whole country, not just London, to seize to a halt. People went crazy. They thought maybe the killer was on the very mail coach which had brought the news. They hired bodyguards. They put up extra shutters. They had doors within doors. It was a form of hysteria that was increased even more when 10 days later it happened again. A few blocks from the original murder site. And this time it was a tavern owner, his wife, and their servant. Same way, same murder, same method. De Quincey was fascinated by this because he felt that it was as if the murders had taken place on a stage for which the audience was all of England. And he analyzed it as he would a Shakespearean play, talking about pity and terror and all that, you know, the Aristotelian stuff that we talk about. And he praised the man who was accused of the murders, a man named John Williams, of being the greatest genius on the blood-spattered stage of all time. He really went to work with his superlatives about these murders. Now, he was writing for magazines, and we have to assume that, you know, some of what he was writing was, you know, to sell magazines. But he wrote about murders a lot, and I became interested in all this because as I'm reading about De Quincey, let me just back up one moment, talk about his Shakespeare criticism. He wrote an essay called On the Knocking at the Gate in Macbeth. And he emphasized the moment in Macbeth when Lady Macbeth and Macbeth have killed the king. And Macbeth says he feels not a woman born, and Lady Macbeth says she feels unsexed. And the play seems to narrow, seems to get darker. It's a moment between the two of them, and De Quincey describes it, it's as if they are in a secret closet of the universe where time has been annihilated. How wonderful he was with phrases. Closet of the universe where time has been annihilated. And then there's a knocking off stage at the gate, and all of a sudden the play rushes forward. It's as if there's been this moment of frozen time, and then whoosh, real life comes back and the action moves forward. And all he wanted to do was analyze that one moment in the play. And what he said, this has been an experiment in what I call psychological criticism. Again, think about, you know, his prefiguring Freud. Well, I'm researching this man. By now it's the Victorian rabbit hole that I've fallen into. Lewis Carroll, a good Victorian author, you know, I began to feel, wow, I'm really sliding down into regions that I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing here, but I'm compelled to keep going. And what I discovered was that he had written about all these murders a three-part essay called On Murder Considered as One of the Fine Arts, hence my title. The first two of these essays were satires in which a gentleman's club, these gentlemen got together and what they had dinner and they talked about great murders and they decided who was a better murderer. You know, was Brutus a great murderer as opposed to, you know, and they'd compare all these. And there's some jokes in it. And meanwhile, we have this John Williams character, this man, you know, being praised for being the best. Well, in 1854, in what's called the Postscript, it's the third of the On Murder Considered as One of the Fine Arts essay, De Quincey invented the true crime genre by, and I love to say this, by writing 50 blood-spattered pages in which he recreated the murders, in which he had the villain going to the shop And then he cut to the shop girl leaving. And then he cut to the victims. And we know how it all turned out. So the suspense, it's like a dreading suspense. We're seeing all of this coming together in this awful event, which is honestly, when I read this, I said, I cannot believe it's never been taught. Or if it has, I'm not aware of it. So that was published in October of 1854, and it was at this point that I hit the bottom of the rabbit slide in a way, because I had this moment when I said, all right, De Quincey would have been 69 in 1854, but he was an athletic kind of guy. I mean, for being a drug addict. The way he's tried not to take the laudanum was by walking. And he walked and walked and walked. And at that time, he was living 20 miles outside Edinburgh, Scotland. And he would think nothing of hiking into the city to deliver manuscript to his publisher. And he had a little brush he carried with him. And he'd pull out the brush and he'd dust each page, you know, and put it down neat and like that. And then he'd get his money, and he'd turn around, and he'd walk 20 miles back home in one day. Seems impossible. He bragged once that in the Lake District, in one summer, he walked 2,000 miles. And so he's 69, and he has a 21-year-old daughter named Emily. He had 8 children. 3 of them were daughters, but Emily was the youngest, and she was the only one around, and she was taking care of him, in effect. One of my favorite stories about him, I didn't find a way to use it in the book. De Quincey'd be leaning over a table with a candle, you know, and he's writing, and Emily would say, "Father, your hair's on fire again." "Oh, thank you, Emily." And he'd bat out the embers and keep writing. "Your hair is on fire again." You know? And I got to thinking, this 21-year-old woman, young woman, 69-year-old man, you know, what is the history between them? And she had been raised in a very unusual way. First of all, because she would, through De Quincey, have known all of, you know, words. Well, I wonder if she knew. I'd have to go and check. But De Quincey was a close friend of Wordsworth and Coleridge, and many, many other of the greats of the period. And you know, she had known, as it were, the royalty of English literature. We don't know a whole lot about her, but I got to thinking that she would be an independent woman. A almost an early version of a woman's rights person, and I thought I have an interesting pair here. 1854 October. This is sort of the way things were going in my head, and all of a sudden I thought, what if he leaves Edinburgh and comes to London? He was in perpetual debt. Comes to London to promote his work. The collected works were coming out. Now, I like this idea because it's very undignified. You know, the British, even today, don't think much of what I'm doing here. You know, I'm selling books, right? And it's sort of undignified. And they, you know, they'll usually read a little bit and nod, and, you know, through the force of, I don't know, divine inspiration or something, people will, you know, decide to buy their books. And I thought, you know, it would be marvelous. He's going to come and he's going to talk to booksellers and newspaper writers and magazine writers and be very undignified. And this will happen in December of 1854. 2 months after the third, the really serious essay is published, and the murders will start again. And he hasn't been back to London in 25 years. And he's obsessed with the murders. And he's a drug addict. I wonder who committed the crimes. And that would be the springboard to turn De Quincey into a detective at the beginning of the detective tradition, because Edgar Allan Poe loved De Quincey and imitated him in works such as Follow the House of Usher. And we know that Edgar Allan Poe invented the detective story in Murders in the Rue Morgue. And we know that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle intentionally, deliberately, and admittedly ripped Poe off by stealing the setup that Poe used in Murders in the Rue Morgue and turning it into Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. What Poe had was a detective named Dupin who was eccentric in his own way, and he had a first-person friend who told the story of Dupin's adventures. Well, that's Sherlock Holmes, basically. Watson writing about Sherlock Holmes. And Conan Doyle made no secret of this, that it had been from his reading of Poe that he decided to do this. So I thought it was interesting. We have Holmes being influenced by Poe, Conan Doyle being influenced by Poe, Poe being influenced by De Quincey, who has not only founded the true crime genre, but also was instrumental in the thriller format, because in Wilkie Collins's The Moonstone, which is also the first major detective novel as opposed to short story, Wilkie Collins uses De Quincey to solve the crime. He quotes from Confessions of an English Opium Eater in order to solve the riddle. So I thought, this is cool. De Quincey is going to be accused of the crime. Scotland Yard, which now exists, is going to go after him, and he's going to be so annoyed by the abuse to which his work has been put, because the killer is using his essay as the blueprint, is basically recreating everything that's in the essay. And I thought, this could be interesting, because it fits, it's a new way, it's a new kind of detective. It's a detective who anticipates Freud. It's a way to have a modern character in a Victorian drama. And from there, I went on another rabbit hole adventure, because it occurred to me that you can't just sit down and write a novel about 1854 London. And especially as an Americanist, I had to do my research, which I'm known for, in order to convince the reader. And this became, I had a note next to my computer, make readers believe they are in 1854 London. So the only way to do that was to dive into the period. And I had three ways of doing it. De Quincey wrote thousands and thousands of pages, and I reread those thousands and thousands of pages until, as an editor said, I became a ventriloquist for him. I could ream off, I could talk like him. And then I read every document I could get, every book I could get about Victorian culture. Specifically, London in the 1850s. It was a very narrow, thank heaven, range that I was researching. How much did a woman's clothes weigh in 1854 London? When I had this breakthrough, I said, I'm getting close, and I won't go through the whole thing. If I have time, sometimes I ask somebody, and they'll say, because they're exaggerating, they'll say 10 pounds. They think they're exaggerating. And I'll go like this, and they'll say 15 pounds, 20, 25, surely not 30. Well, the answer is 37 pounds. And then, of course, the question is, how can that be? And the answer to that is that in the 1850s, this changed. Before 1851, it was different, and in the 60s, it was different. But in the 1850s, they wore metal hoops beneath their dresses, sort of bird cages. Or if they weren't metal, they were made from whale's teeth. Regardless, they weighed. There was a weight to them. And these things had to be covered. So the volume that it took to cover them was 10 yards of ruffled satin. So ladies, how would you like to walk around with 10 yards of ruffled satin all the time? Now it gets better. Because the darn things kept popping up. So that required all sorts of undergarments, which added to the weight. But they still were popping up, so they started putting lead weights in the hems of the dresses to keep them from popping up. Now, is that nuts or what? But how cool, right? And I had this moment, I said, if I can tell people, if I know how much a woman's clothes weighed in 1854, and I know what the streets are made of, and I know what coins, and they didn't, they tended not to have paper money. The Bank of England had not yet been established as we understand it. And the paper money was essentially notes issued by private banks, which had no collateral. If the bank went under, the note was worthless. But the coins were guaranteed. So people tended not to have bank notes, but instead to have gold, copper, or silver coins. And so it was just so interesting to be able to know what color were the men's clothes. Prince Albert was Queen Victoria's husband was a glowery man and very moral, so he thought. The prior royalty had been very flamboyant, and they wanted to distance themselves from that. So the edict was that gentlemen could wear only black, gray, or dark blue clothing, rarely, maybe dark brown. And so, you know, some of you are horror fans too, and you know Richard Matheson's work, and there's a book of his called Bid Time Return, which became an interesting movie, one I like called Somewhere in Time, in which the main character, through force of will, goes back in time. And coins have a lot to do with it. And I began to think that I was a character in a Richard Matheson novel, because I did not read, for the 2 years I was doing the research, any contemporary fiction. I tried to stay away from anything that would break the spell. I read nonfiction that was only related to the 1850s in London. And the fiction was fiction from the period. The one that made the most impression on me, not no news here, was Dickens's Bleak House, which was published in 1853, very close to the period. And I also read a lot of Wilkie Collins. He's in the 60s, but close enough. And the idea was to somehow convince myself, and it worked. I truly began to feel that I was there. That might have been enough to convince people they were in 1854 London, but there was one other detail that I'll tell you about, and then I'm going to take some questions. Let's put it this way. I was trained, you know, in graduate school, and as a professor, I taught this principle that the way a book is written ought to reflect the topic, the substance of the book. In academic jargon, this is called form matching content. And it quickly became evident to me that if I was going to set a novel in 1854 London, I was going to have to write an imitation Victorian novel. Now, the main technique of the Victorian novel, if you discount Wilkie Collins, but if you look at Trollope and other people of the period, the main technique is something called the third-person omniscient viewpoint. the start of Dickens's Tale of Two Cities. Everybody knows it. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Well, that's not seen from a character's point of view. That's the narrator coming forward. That's Dickens telling the reader information. And it's the last novel I can think of that used the third-person omniscient viewpoint extensively was John Fowles's The French Lieutenant's Woman. I mean, it's hardly ever used because the narrator breaks frame. The narrator starts talking to you rather than through a character. But I loved the technique, and I saw a way in which it could be used in a big-time way to write an imitation Victorian novel, try something new in the thriller format, and give the reader all kinds of information that I couldn't do any other way. In if you read Dickens, there's always that feeling that he's not telling us something. It's hard to understand what it is that is going on in some scenes because they took for granted all kinds of cultural things that we don't know about. So what I decided was that each chapter would begin in an omniscient way, the way Dickens likes to do, in which the narrator would come on and explain about laudanum or the history of the police force in London or the history of burial practices. In effect, the narrator says, you can't understand this scene unless you understand burial practices. And it's pretty cool, actually, because the land was so scarce, they buried caskets 20 feet deep. And what they do is when they wanted to bring in a new casket, the grave diggers would excavate, and then they'd literally get in the grave and jump up and down and compact the 20 caskets that were already there so they could get one more in. How cool. And so basically, you know, each chapter began with this and then lapsed into the standard third person as you understand it, but also because Bleak House has alternating omniscient third person and first person, and because Wilkie Collins loved, who's basically the inventor of the modern thriller in The Woman in White. They called him a sensation novelist. I love that, sensation novelist. And that he sometimes used like six or seven first person narrators in a row in journals. So the book became a mixture of third-person omniscient and first-person from Emily de Quincey's journal. And, I cannot tell you from a writing point of view how liberating it was to be able to tell the reader information without having to go through these dreadful scenes where people sit and say, well, you know, Charles, are you aware that... You know, I mean, they're always so bogus because you know that they're not talking for each other. They're trying to give the reader information. So why not get rid of the whole thing and just say, you know, this is the story. It was, I think, largely through the third-person omniscient informative narrator that people began to feel they were in 1854. And the best reviews I've had, I was very pleased. Entertainment Weekly really came down in favor of this book. And one of the things they kept saying about it was that they, you know, you really feel you're there. The comments I've been getting are about that. And it's, you know, 2 years of research and 1 year's to write it. This has been a big endeavor for me and a big challenge because, as I said, it was a switch to an entirely different way of writing for me. But it's a ride. I thank you for your attendance.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.